This program was originally broadcast in October of 2014.
Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. Tonight, we are on live. When a child dies, their family faces a loss so deep that grieving becomes difficult to experience alone. And even with the best of support from family and friends, the bereavement journey is long and difficult. When your child has died, suddenly it seems like meaning. All meaning has been drained from your life. When you wake up in the morning, it's difficult to get out of bed, much less lead a normal life. All that was right with the world now seems wrong, and you're wondering when or if you'll ever feel better. And those are statements and sentiments from parents who have lost children. Recently, two women, both of whom have lost a child, organized a Juno chapter of Compassionate Friends, part of a national organization that provides personal support to families experiencing the death of a son or daughter, a brother or a sister, or a grandchild. So tonight, I'd like to welcome Donna Knight Staten and Sunny Haight, who are co-founders of the Juno group, Compassionate Friends. So, Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And, Sunny, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming. Donna, let's start with you. What led you to organize the group?
Well, something that I never experienced or thought I would ever have the opportunity to experience, but in 2013 I lost my son, Ryan, and extremely difficult. He was 24 years old. He was the youngest and the only son, and it was just an extremely difficult time for our family and continues to be.
And how did you hear about Compassionate Friends?
Well, I was going to counseling, and one of my counselors turned me on to it, and then I went to the website and ordered their materials, and so that's how I first heard about it.
So I would think it would be... It could be very difficult to really put your... It's just been 3 years now since you lost your son?
It's been 19 months.
Okay, we count in months.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 19 months. Yeah, so, oh yeah, not that long ago. Well, I think it was very brave of you to get in the thick of it and do that. And I just noticed at the high school, there's the car that... was part of a crash for a young person who died in a car crash. And the parents are also doing something around their son's death, which is to really, I think it had to do with drinking and driving. And I think they bring out the crash, the horribly mangled car every year as part of what they can do to make some meaning out of the loss of their son. And what you're doing is reaching out to others. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And, Sunny, what motivated you to get involved in starting the group?
Well, like Donna, the horrible experience of losing a child.
And how long has it been?
Savannah died in June of 2012, so next month will be 4 months.
Okay.
Four years, but, you know, it's funny because sometimes it seems like it was yesterday. It's shocking to me that it's actually been almost 4 years.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about the journey in this program, but early on, very, very difficult to cope. I had a good support group of friends and family that I'm very close to, but I think it was about a year or so afterwards that I started to realize I needed something more. I had gone to counseling and, you know, had a wonderful counselor, but it wasn't hitting the mark for me. And I knew of someone else who also is a part of our group that had lost her child, and she had shared with me early on about the Compassionate Friends. I had several other parents in town who had lost a child that reached out in compassion and actually mentioned the Compassionate Friends. And so that name was familiar to me. I looked on their website like Donna did, and I was kind of waiting for a couple of years, I think, for someone else to maybe start a local chapter, and that didn't happen. And so last summer, it was just something that I personally felt like I needed to do, because I needed more support myself, and I recognized how many other people in town were very likely in the same position. So I reached out to the national office and got the paperwork coming, and I think it was about maybe 2 months into it. I hadn't finished the paperwork. It's difficult to take that step, as you've recognized, but you know, taking it a step further and trying to draw people in and actually create a chapter was a little bit daunting. And so the national office called me back at some point along the way and said, hey, we have another call from someone in Juneau that's interested in starting a chapter. Do you want to just team up with her instead of having you start two different chapters? And I said, of course. And so that's how I met Donna. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know each other. We had actually at least one person in common that had told us both about the Compassionate Friends. And so, you know, two strangers having experienced that kind of loss, we decided to forge ahead. The national office does want at least a core group of four individuals to form an advisory committee. And so the two of us, you know, got together with two other individuals that we know. And, you know, we all signed on to be the advisory committee and then kind of divvied out some initial roles to get the paperwork
going. But an advisory committee.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. So could you, one of you, either of you, give me a sense of how the group is structured?
Well, so we meet monthly. And we are a new group. I want to stress that. We started meeting in January. We actually just had our fourth meeting last week. Yeah, we skipped one. So we've had four meetings. And we're still very small. We're still, I would say, forging our way, trying to establish who we are and what our meeting is going to look like every month. But we do have a regular agenda. We start out, we read the credo from the Compassionate Friends and do some introductions. You know, right now it's just a core group of, I would say, 4 to 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we've picked topics. You know, the national organization has been extremely helpful about providing information, how to structure your group, how to run it, different topics that we can cover. And so we've gone through that information and chosen, certain topics to address. And we kind of go around and read off questions and answer them. It's very personal.
It's confidential.
The ground rules are it's confidential. Everybody's welcome. There's no judgment. There's no rules about how you're supposed to grieve. We're not professionals. This is a support group. Mm-hmm. And we're simply there to lift each other up, to try to help each other through the tough times. And we're at different stages in our loss. And, you know, personally, we're all different stages in our life, too. And so we're hoping to offer friendship and support. And as the group grows, again, we are a new group. We hope to, you know, gain more insight from the national level and from each other and what the community needs are and try to meet those.
Yes. And the group is for adults. And it could be adult siblings, grandparents.
Right. There's no one. It's only people that only older people. We don't want to have children there.
Right. So adults. Okay.
Family members who have lost a
child. And family members. And the cause of death is not the issue.
It is not the issue.
So what would it also include, say, a 60-year-old parent who lost a 40-year-old child?
Of course.
Of course.
Of course it would
okay.
be.
Okay. Even adult. Because when we say child, sometimes it could be confused that the deceased person had to be a minor.
Right.
But we mean if it's your child or grandchild.
Regardless
or sibling,
of age or how they died.
Regardless.
Correct.
Regardless of age.
And we have a real difference in some of us. They want us to start going into this group or start putting this group together if you've been out for 18 months from the loss of your child.
I was wondering about that. So a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Okay. They wanted a year and a half out from the loss.
Not to be a participant, but to be part of the original advisory committee
okay.
to start
right.
the group.
Oh,
In order to start the group, you need to be at least 18 months out of your grief. Of course, the group welcomes anyone.
At any
it could have been a week after your child died.
Oh, okay.
But I think they're looking for some stability in terms of leadership.
Absolutely.
So,
and also, it's just not the thing to take on when you're in the early stages
not.
Of grief.
Exactly.
It's the last thing you need to do.
Exactly. Yeah. We have one woman who comes and she lost her child 20 years ago. So that's, you know, there's that much of a span of time frame.
Did either of you think about going to the hospice bereavement group?
I was not invited to that. I don't think.
It's
I don't,
not
I don't
an
think
invitation.
I,
it's just you finding out it's happening and they put posters around town. And it's hard to know, you know, because really the only notification is if your adult loved, if your loved one had been cared for by hospice, mm-hmm. they will have your name and address and inform you of the group. Otherwise, it's just a few posters around town. So I think people don't know of it.
Well, I would say that losing your child is, it puts you in a category that's very different from any other type of loss. And so while hospice is wonderfully amazing and what they do mm-hmm. and serves a really needed purpose for the community. Losing a child is very, very specific. And my personal experience, and I think the experience of the other people in the group, is that there is no one out there that you can relate to.
You know what?
Quite like somebody who has actually lost a child.
And I totally agree, because
yeah.
I led the bereavement group for hospice for about a decade, and occasionally we'd get parents who had lost a child, but I really wished that if we were a bigger town, a larger population, we're too small a population, mm-hmm. We could barely field the 8 to 10 people twice a year that we needed to have that kind of group interaction. And I really felt that very strongly, that if I could have, and if I were in Seattle with hospice, and I'm sure larger cities have special bereavement groups led by a professional just for parents who lose children,
right.
but we don't have that here, and that makes your group even more valuable, because
well,
you're the only place they can go.
And I'm wondering if maybe people are beginning to be more open, because I did go to a bereavement group or grief group 2 Thursdays ago with Dr. Urata and some other professionals, Jameson McLean, and there were over 50 people there. It was quite amazing.
Oh, great.
So that was
in the Compassionate Friends, yeah, it's not a new organization. It's been around for, you know, close to 50 years. There's over 650 chapters across the U.S. It is a national,
right.
well-founded organization. I just actually looked it up today. I thought there was 4, but there's only 5 chapters in Alaska. So, you know, the 650 spread across the U.S., there's
yes.
5 in Alaska.
And they have annual conferences. Have either of you been to a conference yet?
I'm actually going in July for my first time to the national conference.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
Where is
I'm
it going to be held?
The part I'm not excited about is it's in Scottsdale, Arizona.
That is not good for us Junoites.
For a reason.
We will. Yes, Scottsdale will be a little on the warm
side. But
it'll
be well air conditioned. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, you'll be just fine. You'll just absorb all that heat and bring it home when it's cold like it is today.
And a learning experience. I think that's. Which that'll help
yeah.
our group to be.
Oh, yeah. To go to a national conference is absolutely crucial. I have been on the website and looked at it very thoroughly, and I think it's very well developed, very wonderful. And, boy, it gives you great resources. In fact, if I had known it was there when I was leading the hospice bereavement group, I would have used it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very good. You said the Compassionate Friends have a credo. Do you happen to have it with you, and could you read it?
I do, actually.
It's right there.
Yeah, this one's a little bit bigger.
Okay.
Even with reading glasses, I need the bigger one. So this is the credo for the national group, and we do take the time to read this at the beginning of
The beginning of every meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
The Compassionate Friends Credo, we need not walk alone. We are the Compassionate Friends. We reach out to each other with love, with understanding, and with hope. The children we mourn have died at all ages and for many different causes, but our love for them unites us. Your pain becomes my pain, just as your hope becomes my hope. We come together from all walks of life, from many different circumstances. We are a unique family because we represent many races, creeds, and relationships. We are young and we are old. Some of us are far along in our grief, but others still feel a grief so fresh and so intensely painful that they feel helpless and see no hope. Some of us have found our faith to be a source of strength, while some of us are struggling to find answers. Some of us are angry, filled with guilt, or in deep depression, while others radiate an inner peace. But whatever pain we bring to this gathering of the Compassionate Friends, it is with pain we will share, just as we share with each other our love for our children who have died. We are all seeking and struggling to build a future for ourselves, but we are committed to building a future together. We reach out to each other in love to share the pain as well as the joy, to share the anger as well as the peace, share the faith as well as the doubts, and help each other to grieve as well as to grow. We need not walk alone. We are the Compassionate Friends.
Wow, what a great way to start each group, because it really kind of sets the tone. It reminds you. And you mentioned, Donna, that it's confidential.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience with the bereavement group and confidentiality is that people respected it 100%. I mean, it was a very safe place to be.
That's what we want is we want people to feel they can come and talk, and it's not going to go anyplace else.
And it's not going to be judged.
Yeah.
Yeah. With your numbers, of course, we know that's just a drop in the bucket of the number of families in Juneau that have lost a child. Even the number of families, let's say, that have lost a child in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
What do you think it is that has people reluctant to come to a group?
I think one thing, one of the pieces that I read about Compassionate Friends is that studies show that if we go to a group and talk about our child, that it's more of a healing experience for us. And I don't think people realize that. I think people hold back, and some people just stay in their home and don't even don't go out and visit with people, and their life changes totally.
In other words, they withdraw from the world.
Yes.
And that's pretty scary. And grieving, from my knowledge of grieving and bereavement, requires contact with other people. It requires communication. That solitary grieving never heals, never moves on. So how do you think that Compassionate Friends can encourage people to join?
Well, that's an interesting question.
We're doing it word of mouth right now, and it's also advertised in the newspaper in the Capital City Weekly.
Oh, so, it is good.
And I think what we're doing is we're planning to work on a website, but that's
mm-hmm.
we're still working on a lot.
That's a little ways off. I think we're in agreement, though, that our goal isn't that this group is a sort of campaign and that we need to get a ton of exposure right away. It is word of mouth. Juneau's a small community. We each know a handful of people who have lost a child, and through our interactions with them, we continue to remind people. I'll send out a Facebook message the day before our meeting, and it gets reposted by a few people. I think we're all I guess I won't speak for all of us. I'll speak for myself. My hope for the group isn't that it would just explode by having 20 people show up one or two times and then it doesn't quite meet their need and so mm-hmm. they leave, but that we start very small, like mm-hmm. we have. We build trust, we build companionship, and we build friendship. And as we experience in the group ourselves, not just the idea of what the group means, but that we've actually sat there for 6 or 8 meetings and it has actually helped us, that we, as exhausting as it might be to go and to share with each other, even though it's once a month, it is yeah. exhausting. It takes a toll. But if we can share with other people, that it's also meaningful for us, that it gives us an outlet that we don't have otherwise to engage with other people who truly get it, mm-hmm. that's the type of snowball effect yes. that I would like to see.
Yes.
And that might just be a really slow snowball that
so.
Starts out small. And maybe it always stays small and we have just a core group. And that's okay as far
yes.
as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. And I think you're very wise because, first of all, word of mouth is truly what has people want to try something. And especially if it's from a friend or a respected acquaintance who's had a positive experience with the group, it's very likely to reduce the fear. Of course, they can always just say, the way I work when I was in private practice with my clients is I use the same trick for myself for things I'm scared to do, you know, go to. And it is, just try it once. You know, you don't have to go back. Just try it once and see how
you
it
know,
goes.
You know, it's interesting. I actually just read again. I think throughout the literature, it encourages people, try to come 3 times.
Right.
Try to come to the group more than once.
Good.
Because you may come on a day when, like last week, it was actually me, Donna, and one other person. It was just 3 of us. And so we just had a completely casual conversation the whole time we were meeting. And another time there might be 7 people and maybe it'll be a little more formal where we'll actually read some questions off and go around and answer them. Something's going to hit somebody different each time. And so I think trying it, you know, whether it's 3 or it's 2, but at least a couple of times to
I
find
like that.
Out.
I see the wisdom of that. And because mm-hmm. the group could be so different each
right.
time because it's such mm-hmm. a new group. We started to talk about how useful it is for people to have a safe container for being able to talk about what's most on their mind, which is the loss of their child. Have either of you had, what are your own personal experiences of having the group versus if the group weren't here, if you hadn't started it?
I think you'd be grieving alone. I think you'd be still, because you do have friends that are very helpful to you, but I think there's a point where they get tired of hearing, or at least I feel they don't want to hear about the situation again because it's negative. It's not very happy.
Mm-hmm.
So we can come to this group and have a genuine conversation where we all relate in this particular manner.
Yeah, so. And a lot of, you know, just the probability that you would have a close friend who had also lost a child is pretty low. So most of your friends will never know really what you're going through.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it is the relatability. I mean, you can have, and I feel like I have some really wonderful friends that I could talk to endlessly, and maybe I feel like they get tired of it, but they would still listen. But there's a difference between talking to somebody who we go through these same things, you know, whether it's, it's on the spot, I can't think of anything right now, but there are certain triggers or certain things that
yeah.
we've all gone through. And you can say in the group, God, don't you hate it when, you know, this particular thing happens, or, you know, you're coming up on whether it's an anniversary or just a certain event or
Christmas.
Sure.
Christmas.
How to deal with certain
birthdays.
Things. And people get it. I mean, even we talked one time about, gosh, when you go to the store, especially shortly afterwards, and you run into people who have this look, and we all knew what that look was. It's mm-hmm. this probing look that people with desperate eyes look at you, and because they don't know what to say, and they're sure you're going to break down too. And we all know that look. I mean, we all just looked at each other like, God, that one's so painful, because you want to avoid them just as much as they want to avoid you.
Or they approach you.
Yes, all different scenarios of how
many,
that could play out.
And in the bereavement group I led, it was the same thing for, say, new widows or widowers. You know, people would look at them, that look, and then they would almost be like deer in the headlight. And then if people came up and hugged them, that may be absolutely what they don't need at the moment, or it could be what they really want.
Mm-hmm.
And what to say.
And I think also it's interesting, because I'm not sure, I haven't had it happen recently, but I've had some people come up to me and ask me how Ryan's doing, what, you know, how's he doing in school? And that's the one that just takes your breath away, because then you have to tell them.
What do you say?
Well, you tell them what happened.
They've been
gone for this amount of time.
I remember at a campground, my husband and I were in our camper camping, and we were chatting with the people who were camping next door, and we said, how many children do you have? And both...
We hate that question.
And...
We do.
And they, you know, there was this awkward pause, and I knew immediately something was up. What do?
It's an awkward pause for me. I mean, it's been almost 4 years, and I don't have a perfect answer.
Yeah.
I think it depends on who's asking, what the circumstances are. I have yet to not include Savannah.
And I feel the same. I think the thing that was interesting, we have had this conversation, and each of us had sort of a different take on it. Mm-hmm. And it's good to see that we all have different perspectives.
Yes. And there's not like a recipe book on how to answer, because
no.
You can feel differently about it.
No, there's not. And yeah. You're right, Don. I recall one of them had a lovely response, which was something along the lines of, I have, you know, two children I can hug and one I visit in my dreams, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, each of us is individual, and
I
do include my daughter.
Okay. Well, hey, in a moment we're going to take a short musical break. And let me tell folks that you're listening to Mind Over Matter, and I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. And tonight my guests are Donna Staten Knight and Sunny Haight, co-founders of Compassionate Friends, a Juno group that supports families who have lost a child. We'll be right back after the music. Thank you. Welcome back to our discussion about bereavement and support for families who have lost a child. I am Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and I'm talking in the studio with Donna Knight-Staton and Sunny Haight, who are co-founders of the Juno Group Compassionate Friends, which is part of a larger national organization of the same name. And just a moment ago, we were talking about some of the real common experiences, running into people in the grocery store, how to handle various social situations. And I'd like to kind of continue on with that, because one thing I noticed from leading the bereavement group, for somebody who's just suffered a gigantic loss, like the loss of a child or a spouse, you think you're going crazy.
That's exactly right.
And during our break, you both mentioned something about your children's ashes still being in the home. I remember other bereaved people talking about the clothing, the child's belongings, what you deal. I mean, the material world, the child's remains, the child's belongings. What has your, experience been?
That was one of our discussion questions that we had as a round robin. And again, everyone in the group had a different way of approaching what they did with their child's belongings. Either they gave them away to friends. I would say most people still have them. What do you think, Sunny?
Most people, yeah. I mean, to varying degrees, I think. It depends on how old their child was, too. Some who have adult children who were already out of the house,
right.
They don't necessarily have their belongings. I have all of my daughter's things. And
you keep them all?
I do keep them all, and I have no plan or thought about when I might be ready to part with them. That I may sound weird. It might be my children who end up having to deal with it after I'm gone, because I'm just not ready to part with them.
I understand.
And, who knows if it's the age or the circumstance that would dictate some of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly, here one moment and tragedy strikes the next. Her
yes.
room is set up perfectly. And
yes.
And in the case of my son, he had been away to school for a number of years, and so his room was pretty much gone. So, but we still have, he was away at college, so we had to go down and collect, and these things were in storage because he was home working. But we had to go down to the storage and collect all of the things that were his, including furniture and just all the belongings, clothing, his books, and that was all brought back up to Juno, except for the furniture went to different friends or to family members.
Mm-hmm. And Sunny, for example, your daughter was still a teenager. She was still at home. Did you keep her bedroom pretty much intact, or did you change furniture around?
If I had my way, I would say I would have. We have different family dynamics, kids younger and older, and we had certain, rooms that were better than others.
Yes, yes.
Kids coming home from college. So at some point, we did move Savannah's room downstairs to another bedroom, and her sister is occupying her room. She's away at college, but her stuff is in there. So we moved Savannah's things, but they're still in a bedroom in the house.
And they're still in a dedicated bedroom, or is it a guest? Yeah,
they are. It's changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I went through periods where I thought I would put some stuff away, so I put it in boxes, and then we moved her bedroom downstairs, and my son came home for a while, and so we moved it to the next bedroom over, and so it's half put up, half not, but it's, her obvious things, the color, the things that made me immediately think of her whenever I went in her bedroom, those are all up and visible,
mm-hmm.
and,
Yeah. Well, you were talking about how there was always varied reactions to people in, by people in the group to various, you know, triggers.
Right.
And so, too, it can be in a family. So the death of a child can certainly stress relationships with your spouse, with your kids, your other kids, because everybody grieves differently. And I'm just thinking of the simple thing of saving belongings or giving them away. And your husband may feel like it's time to give them away or change things around. And those are such, you know, delicate things. I mean, what a wonderful thing to be able to share in the group. You know, the people are going through similar difficulties and ways to work it out.
I think with my family, Ryan was the youngest of the family. Everyone had been in college, so my oldest daughter lived away, and my middle daughter was a year and a half away from him in age, and they were very close. I'd say she has probably been the most affected out of parents are also affected, but I think younger people, death is something that's far, far away, but when it's the death of a close friend, it's very, very traumatic. And I think that affected her dramatically.
Yeah. And you still have kids. Do you still have kids at home, or have they left the nest?
Yes. I have two younger stepkids, but they're with us full time. They have them.
Uh-huh.
They're both teenagers in high school. My oldest daughter is 21. Her and Savannah were just 16 months apart. They were extremely close.
Uh-huh.
And then my son is 24.
Okay. We were talking earlier about, you know, running into people, and for some, the immediate reaction soon after the loss is wanting to be alone, isolation, to just curl up and not leave the house. Had either of you experienced that, a desire just to kind of disappear, not deal with the world?
I did. We both had different experiences.
I have a totally different experience.
Yeah. And maybe you want to hear from both of us.
Yeah, I do. I want to hear from both of you.
It was a dark time. It would be difficult to try to explain the early days. It was a very, very dark time.
Mm-hmm.
And the trauma of it all was enormous. It was very difficult to see for many months that I would ever get out of what I can only describe as a black pit of, you know, pardon the expression, but of hell. I mean,
yeah.
That is what it felt like.
Yeah.
And I honestly did not see getting out of that. And that is, I would say, a point that in this group, in the Compassionate Friends, and as we meet people, and as time goes on a little bit, it's astounding to me that I can actually say now, I'm in, you know, not like a wonderful, great place and every day is perfect, but I never thought that I would actually smile again or have fun again or, you know, be productive again.
Uh-huh.
So that those early days, months mm-hmm. of grief were very, very overwhelming. And I probably did sink into isolation, whereas, you know, when Donna talks, she'll have a different story. It took a lot to get out of that, to even go to the store, to be in public, to be around people. It was very difficult for me.
Were you working, Sonny?
I was. And I'm really grateful that I was able to take, you know, I think the first 5 weeks I didn't even go back to work. After that, had a lot of flexibility to work part-time for the next month. And mm-hmm. I think after about 2.5 months, I was back at work full-time. And I was functioning, and that's the amazing thing about people, is you can go through life and appear to be quite functional and get your job done and get done at home what you need to, but people don't see what's going on internally and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting through. It was nothing more than getting through the days.
Well, grieving is exhausting.
It was exhausting.
I consider
it still is.
Virtually, especially in the early stages, a full-time job. So if somebody has a full-time job and they're grieving, it's just overwhelming. I mean, just fatiguing, exhausting. And it's hard to think of an emotional state as being exhausting, but grieving is really, really hard work.
It
just wears you out. I would think, Sunny, your experience of being in such a dark place for a while, for, you know, considerable amount of time, and then moving into a different place, a better place, would be very important to people who come to the group who are in the dark place now and who think they'll never smile again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So, Donna, what was your experience?
Well, I think with my personality, I dove right back into work, and I took counseling. I went to classes once a week. I was working on a campaign for an election at that time frame. So I just pushed myself back in and just kept really, really busy and really going. And I found probably after 5 months that all of a sudden I was just breaking down and I was just crying more and just realizing that I couldn't continue on. And that's when I took from work a leave of absence, and I'm old enough that I could have retired, and I decided after the leave of absence that I probably should just retire, and I think that was a really good step for me.
To retire.
To retire.
So you didn't feel like you needed your work as a way to distract yourself?
No, no. I needed time. I think I worked hard right after Ryan's death, and then it came to the feeling that I needed to give myself more time and more time to grieve and not try and shove it off.
Exactly. One of the things that can happen if maybe you have very young children, maybe you have to go back to work right away, is that since grieving is a job, you can't do two jobs at the same time. And what it can do, if you're too busy, you're forced to, or you try to be too busy to push it away, it just saves it for later. You've still got to do it. There's just, it seems like there's a certain amount of grief. This is my personal experience and also what I read in the research. It takes time. It takes as long as it takes. And we need breaks once in a while, and that can be good for some personalities like yours, where, Donna, you know, it was better for you to go back to work for a while.
Well, I loved my work, and I worked with kids, and that's always joyful. So that was, you know, helpful for me.
Yeah, yeah. And there are many, many emotional reactions to the death of a child, and one of them can be guilt. Feeling, even in the most preposterous of cases, and I remember reading in a book that had stories by parents who had lost a child, a mother who had carefully put her child's bicycle helmet on and had sent her child out on a bicycle like every parent in that neighborhood did every single day, and then the child was hit by a car randomly and died. And she felt if only that day she had not let her child go on that bicycle ride. Even though it makes absolutely no sense, you can feel guilty. Does that ring a bell for either of you?
It does. It does. It rings a bell.
Yeah.
It's why was I gone out of town at that time frame?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Sure, there's a little bit of that in there, but for me, there's a whole host of emotions, and I haven't dealt with guilt as strongly as other emotions or as other people, depending on the circumstances of death. Yes, I dropped her off at the lake that day, but I mean, I'm a really rational person too, and there's
yes.
probably no other way you can contain a 16-year-old who's bound and determined to have some fun on the hottest day of the year. You know, it wasn't my fault. I know that.
Yeah.
But sure, there's always things that creep in.
What about anger?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, anger and anger can be, we could say rational and irrational. Irrational would be anger at the child for dying. For leaving you, even though you know that they didn't want to die.
And they weren't planning on it, no.
Nope. And if the death is not caused by suicide, and certainly anger at the drunken driver, at anger at the circumstances.
I think anger at God for, how could you take a child? That's the thing that we just talk about a lot, is how could you possibly take a child?
Yes. Which can create a crisis of faith.
I think the circumstances is what I personally would struggle with the most when it comes to anger.
With the circumstances?
The circumstances of
your daughter's death.
Of her death, yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah,
I don't know if you're comfortable sharing that or not. We don't need to go into it. Okay,
yeah.
So, but it was an accident, known as, you know, like an automobile
mm-hmm.
accident, and of course, you could be going through it 24 hours a day in your mind, the whole thing. And that's another thing. Endless obsessive thinking can be another issue
right.
and is likely to be, especially in the beginning, but then you don't want it to hold on forever.
Yeah, I don't know, Donna, if you dealt with that, but that's what I remember from those early days is just sitting alone and literally reliving every single moment, every day for a couple months.
Wow.
From, you know, the time you get the call to every horrifying step along the way, going to the hospital, medevacing, being out of town, watching your child die, going through, you know, organ donation and feeling. Oh. There's so many traumatic events
yeah.
that are horrifying along the way.
Uh-huh.
And every single one is imprinted in your brain. And for me, I relived every single moment, just played over in my mind
uh-huh.
every day for weeks, for months.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I think one thing also is we've had friends who said maybe you should take the pictures down now. Would it be more helpful if you didn't have the pictures? And we're not planning on taking the pictures down anytime soon or ever.
Right.
I think the hardest times for me are in the evening when I'm going to bed. I always have to say goodbye to Ryan, and I have a little urn that's right next to my bedside, and waking up in the morning and thinking about him again, that he's, you know, well, he's not here again. It's just it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that is, it's different personalities. I'm just reminded of somebody I ran into in an airport who also lost a daughter, I think about a year after I did, and we were just catching up after not seeing each other for several years, and I was surprised when she told me that she doesn't keep pictures of her daughter around. She has a couple in her wallet and a few in the house in certain places, but she doesn't have them all over. Me, I have them everywhere. I mean, you could call it a shrine or just, you know, the normal family pictures, but a lot of them focused on her in one particular area. That's something that I need personally, but I recognize that not everybody does. And maybe it's either too painful for her
yes.
or yes. it triggers something else. It would be more painful for me to think that I couldn't see her face every day mm-hmm. than, I mean, I just couldn't bear to do that. So it's very individual.
My clinical professional experience would be that if you had a room of bereaved parents and you said all you who have pictures around go to one side of the room and all those who don't, it'd be pretty even. Maybe not exactly even because you're both hurting so much. Both groups are hurting so much. So one personality is, I can't keep looking at her picture. And the other is, I can't not look at her picture.
Right.
And it's really coming from the same source,
mm-hmm.
which is pain, you know, deep pain. Or I don't want to look at her things. I want her things gone. Or I don't want to let go of her things.
Mm-hmm.
So aren't we humans and our grieving both so similar because mm-hmm. we all are feeling this incredible pain of the loss of a child, and yet the outward expression is different. And it can be that way for each family member, which you know, you can't have pictures there and pictures not there. You know, it's got to be another marital decision of, you know, how you're going to handle just that one small, seemingly small issue. Yeah. Do you find, either of you, that with your surviving children that you might be overprotective, or are you at ease?
Oh, I am not at ease. I worry every single time they're out of my sight. And, of course, my, you know, her two natural siblings, they're both technically adults, and I'm terrified all of the time that something is going to happen to them. You know, my son happens to be staying at home right now. And if he's not home by a certain time, I'm sure it's annoying when you're 24 years old to have your mom texting you at 2 in the morning. But I do.
Mm-hmm. Which you wouldn't have if you hadn't lost your daughter, you think?
Well, yeah, and he was not living at home for a while, too. And so I didn't know if he wasn't home at that time of night or something. But, yes, I would very overprotective. I try not to be overbearing. They understand it. They're very gracious, and they know where I'm coming from, so they try to ward that off by letting me know what's going on all the time. But mm-hmm. I would say I worry. I worried before because as parents you always think, what if something horrible happened, but you really don't believe it ever will happen.
Yes.
Once it does, the reality for you is this actually can happen. It has. And how much more devastated would I be if it happened again? And, you know, if you have young adult children who, you know, once in a while are doing something that's not, you know, the smartest thing in the world, or they're just out traveling the world like one of mine is, you worry.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
I think with my two girls, one of the things that I require of them is that whenever I see them, at the beginning, at the end, we always hug and say I love you. It's really important to just acknowledge that, because I don't think we did that as much before Ryan, and now I'm just very, you know, I want to hug you and I want to say I love you every time.
And you know, one of the aspects of guilt, a very different one, could be I didn't say I loved you enough, or I didn't let you know, you know, or let's not say guilt, let's say regret. You know, I wish I had said it straight, I love you, more often. And with both your experiences, you're obviously really, you know, aware that life is really precious and can change on a dime. Just like instantly, one moment to the next. Were there any other emotional experiences that seemed to be a strong part of either of your journeys in particular?
Well, I know I didn't want to have fun anymore. there was a time frame in there where I would I would not want to have fun. It was like, I'm not sharing this with my son. I'm not, and I just don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
It felt wrong to reengage in life. And
that's what I was wondering.
It really did feel wrong. I remember the first time my husband wanted to go to a movie. It was a couple months afterwards. And and he wasn't pushing. He was just trying to see, was I ready for that? And it just felt wrong. It felt wrong to do anything that might bring some level of enjoyment, but it was about engaging in life. And she didn't get to anymore. And so it took a long time to not feel bad about that, or just to feel like, you know, I kind of had that permission to go about life again. It took quite a while.
Okay. And then both of you started Compassionate Friends. Our time is running out. This has been a wonderful conversation. And if any parents who have lost a child have tuned in, or adult siblings, why don't you quickly say when and where the group meets.
We meet on the first Thursday of every month at the Pioneers Home at 7 o'clock. We generally go from 7 to 9, but we start pretty much at 7 o'clock. Right in the, as you come in the front doors, the dining area off to the left.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's the first Thursday of the month. We just met last week. June 2nd or 3rd, I believe it is.
Okay. And I know they can contact you by Googling Compassionate Friends and then go to the Juno site, and your phone number's there. Is that correct?
They can find the Juno site. Yeah, you can go to the Compassionate Friends, compassionatefriends.org. That's the national site. You can navigate that and find the local chapter. It will have, you know, if you want a local number, my phone number is printed in there.
Yeah, great. Okay. I want to thank Donna and Sonny for organizing a chapter here of Compassionate Friends in Juneau, and for their candor and insight about the deep grieving process that families experience when a child has died. And thanks to Jolly and John Kramers, our loyal technical support team, who reliably keep this technical side of the program flowing. Good night to all our Southeast Alaska listeners. Tune in another Monday next month on KTOO 7 p.m. for Mind Over Matter. Good night.